Controversial. Banned from four clubs. Only Siberia, you fucking degenerates can handle this shit. Alright, you guys have been so fun. I've been Eric Kalibok, Smoke Pot Worship Aliens. Give it up for Coin Guy.
Alright. Legally, I have to say I'm recording. Welcome to Highway Diary episode, I'm not sure exactly, in the next 3 weeks this will air. I'm here with Ken Passman. We're driving to Lafayette as I'm, banned in a couple clubs in New Orleans. I gotta leave town, you know. I'm on the run, I'm an outlaw. I'm here with Ken Passman. You were just saying that you, every time you drive by furniture, you just kind of scope it out.
Yeah, it's like I grew up kind of poor and white trashy, so if I see furniture on the side of the road, I have to stop and check it out or at least give it a good look over. I really don't have to do that anymore. I can afford good furniture, but that is still ingrained in me. It's kind of like a cat that tries to bury a turd on a marble floor. Uh-huh. You know, it's that instinct is still there.
Someone's gonna come by with a paper towel and some Windex, but he's got the digging instincts.
Yes.
So you're also, so now you, when did you start going after comedy? When did that start? What's your story, man?
When did I first considered it? Sometime in my late 30s, like 38, 39, I was working a job, and I just got so disgusted with it, I said something has to change, and at that time I began to listen to a lot of podcasts. And a lot of comedians and stuff on there, and they talked about the process of being a comedian, and it's like, hell, I could do that, you know, just keep getting up on stage, writing jokes, and work toward it, and see if I could make some kind of career change, mm-hmm. eventually, or if nothing else, just be good at it, so mm-hmm. something other than my job, too.
Well, I think I was, how long have you been doing it? I'm kind of, like, at the ground level.
How long, well, I did a couple of open mics, just after my 40th birthday, and then I went to Peru for a while, mm-hmm. and I did some comedy in Lima, and the comedy scene is actually very good. There's a massive city, like 8 million people, and the comedy scene was strong, but I was doing it in Spanish mostly and some English, but they're not very critical about the comedy there, so I wasn't sure if I was any good or not, because they laughed at everything.
Right, right.
So,
well, you kind of got your chops, and you got some confidence right now.
Yes.
And how long were you doing that in South America?
I would do a show maybe twice a week for about 6 months.
Yeah. So, now how long, and then you just moved to New Orleans?
Yeah, I moved back here. I grew up here. I've been gone since about 2002, really. I've been all over the place. Pennsylvania, New York, Texas, Alabama, Mexico, all over the place.
But for a living, you work on oil rigs?
Yes.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, it's like also with doing comedy, it's like people don't understand that you got to, like, do it all the time. And some of my friends are like, what are you doing? I thought we were going to go do this Mardi Gras, like, parade. And I was like, I don't really give a shit about a Mardi Gras parade.
Yeah.
Like, I'll go to the Mardi Gras parade, but not, like, 3 weeks ahead of time. I don't have to get drunk for 3 weeks because it's Mardi Gras. Like, I want to do stand-up, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I want to do. So, like, having a girl, you know, that's a lot of pressure that, like, you gotta hang out all the time, you know?
Yeah, and then the comedy and the oil field stuff, you know, I could be gone for months with the oil field stuff in it by itself.
Right.
And then when I'm home, I don't want to sit around the house and, you know, watch movies with somebody. I'm going out every night I can to do stand-up, get better at that.
Yeah. So has that been, like, a big, relief for you? What have you been getting from stand-up as far as, you know?
Some real gratification to really push myself into an area where I wasn't comfortable. I like to kind of push myself into different zones and, you know, step over out of my comfort zone a little bit and push myself. The more I do it, the stand-up was the perfect thing because I love comedy, and I was terrified to do it in the beginning, but I've pushed past that just to better myself as, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. So, New Orleans has an interesting comedy scene, right? There's a little, you know.
Yeah.
You just gotta get up and do your reps.
Yeah.
But, you know, I find myself stepping on some toes. Maybe that's a huge personality flaw I have. So, you know, I'm working on it, talking to people. But, you know, there is some differences. You know, I guess I just am from the East Coast and we're a little bit more, you know, rough with our friends. You know, we bust balls really hardcore, you know, to kind of relieve pressure. Like, you know, I feel like a lot of people are passive aggressive and I'm kind of just more like confrontational about everything.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think it has to do with the generational thing, too. Political correctness took over, and how dare you know you can't say certain things to certain people. It's
right.
It's really, I come from it. I'm older, you know, than the guys coming up, and I've spent all those years in the oil field too. You can say whatever you want to anybody at any time. You can even punch them in the face every now and then, and it's not that big of a deal.
They're rough dudes.
Yeah, they're just dudes, and they a little few words. You know, you kind of get used to that. So I have to be aware that I when I'm around the comedians, to not say certain things in a certain way. I try not to offend them all too much.
But what do you mean? You try not to offend comedians?
I really don't.
Shouldn't they be like thick-skinned as far as like you know words that are used?
They should be. And but there's the scene here is very, I guess the word would be nascent. It's a music town and it's turned into a comedy town overnight. And they're trying to figure it out. You go to other cities and they understand that kind of thing. It's kind of developed, you know, a camaraderie. You get to know people and you just go back and forth with the you know busting balls. But they're a little sensitive about it here. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't explain it properly. I'm a grown man.
I'm a grown man.
and I'll say whatever I want. Whatever they want to me, I just don't care, man.
I just feel like, you know, the audience decides. That's it.
Yeah.
The audience decides. If you're being funny, that's it. If you're not being funny, then you won't get laughs. That's it. So it's kind of like, you know, as much as there is any kind of perceived hierarchy, there's also just like, if you're doing well, you'll do fine. But I got big problems with authority. You know, I don't like playing any kind of game. I just kind of like doing stuff a certain way. And obviously I have really specific ways in which I think things should be run. So, you know, and I got a big ego, so I clash with people, but whatever. Whatever. But yeah, I really respect you. You know, I started seeing you develop at Siberia, you know, and I felt like you were definitely one of those people that were an Always Lounge and all the places that we're at, you know. I always feel like you're always putting your time in, you're getting your reps in, you're trying new stuff, you know, you're not afraid to test the boundaries of what we're doing. And I think you have, we get along because we just have this same kind of sensibility of, you know, free speech and let's like make a crazy show happen right now. We kind of like embrace the chaos of that.
And whatever it takes.
Kind of have like a confrontational sense of comedy, you know. It is interesting, like, should we kind of talk to some people or just, you know, you look at a certain bar and you just look at the faces and you try to judge them, you know, based on what they would like or, you know, but then you just got to do your stuff, you know.
Yeah.
You were told that you were too violent.
That was in Austin, though. That was in Austin.
What happened?
I have a fictional fight list. It's just a stupid joke that I improvised one night. And I've been using it as my closer. You know, I just say, well, I don't have a lot of material, so I just brought a list of people that I'd like to fight. And the people on there are mostly fictional, you know, or just not real people. But
you're not pointing out at anyone in the crowd and saying, I want to fight you.
No, and I was told in Austin that they don't like the violence talk and stuff like that. It's not violence, it's silliness. There's a difference.
Right.
You know, yeah.
Stop the violence. Who got punched? I took out a piece of paper and said some things.
Don't you tell me not to be violent, you motherfucker.
I'll
show you who's violent. I'm a peaceful person. And if I have to show you how peaceful I am, I will.
So what is it like when you're out on the rig, and how long do you go out for a time?
I go out normally for 2 weeks at a time, and it's...
So it's like 2 weeks on, 1 week off, 2 weeks on, 1 week off?
2 weeks on and 2 weeks off.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, take a boat, helicopter out there, and I have really nice quarters there, but some of the guys have to share really tight quarters and stuff, and I have my own office and stuff like that, so...
You're like the captain of the ship.
No, not a captain, not a captain. I'm a safety consultant, safety and environmental consultant, so I just kind of make sure they comply with, you know... Well, it's not OSHA out there. That's the land stuff. The Coast Guard and the Chevron regulations and policies and stuff like that.
Yeah. Have any of your wells exploded?
No. No, I've been on a rig that caught on fire.
Right.
But it wasn't due to the well itself. But
what happened? A rig caught on fire?
A rig caught on fire. Some insulation on some equipment caught on fire. It really started to go up. We had to get out and... the emergency boats and kind of wait around until somebody came to get us.
Who fixes that?
Who fixes that?
You gotta call a specialist who comes in?
Oh yeah, they have to rebuild the equipment and have it all inspected and stuff like that. It wasn't the whole platform didn't go down. They had fire suppression systems to put it out. But really, we left for precautionary reasons. It was just...
Well, yeah, being on fire.
It was on a... it was a gas well. It was a flowing well.
Right.
So... That was a long time ago. That's a good while. Probably 15 years ago.
So what went wrong, at your estimation, in the Gulf of Mexico? What's going on with these explosive decompression type situations where the gases can't be contained? And who's fucking up?
To me, it was the contractors, like with the BP situation.
Yeah.
They have a blowout preventer, and it wasn't functioning properly. It actually... When they hit a pocket of gas, there's so much pressure coming out of there, they have equipment that actually just shuts it completely, hydraulic equipment.
Yeah.
And it wasn't working. So when they hit the pocket and it came shooting out of there, they had no way to stop it.
Right.
They knew they had tested the equipment, knew it didn't work, and still went forward with the job. So
they knew it didn't work, they checked off broken and then sunk it in the ocean and went, okay, let's...
Yeah, well, this piece is on the rig itself. There's pipes that run up to the casing and stuff. It runs all the way up to the rig. And it's this huge hydraulic system that there are three rams. They shut around the pipe. They cut the pipe. They can cut it off completely. But you have to test that every so often. It has to be tested. You have to test it before you use it. And it did not work. It's kind of like driving a car without brakes. Mm. It's not if you're going to have to stop. It's... when you have to stop. I don't understand that. And BP, there's no way BP would have signed off on that. People took shortcuts there, and it was not... they broke BP's policy. They broke drilling policies for International Association of Drilling Contractors.
But also, then BP is like going to try to lowball this lowest vendor, and then that vendor's going to get the job, and then they're going to be digging for BP in there.
The companies that were there are top-notch companies and contractors. Schlumberger, Halliburton, and guys like that. They are top contractors in the world. I mean, they have great safety records as far as comparatively speaking. They're not trying to lowball it. But I worked on a BP rig in the early 2000s, and we would get these huge bonuses for finishing the well. Before the allotted amount of time, huge bonuses. It would be as much as our pay. So it basically double your pay if you could get it under a certain amount of time. And I think maybe that had something to do with it. They would just got used to these huge bonuses. And if one person on that rig says, no, we can't do this. We can't do this right now because this equipment is not working properly, it could ruin everybody's bonus on that. It could cut everybody's pay in half for that month.
Right.
The entire rig, maybe 200 people.
Right.
So you would get blamed for cutting everybody's pay in half, basically, when it's not really their pay, it's a bonus. But when people get used to getting, like, $5,000 a month bonuses...
Right.
If one person's going to say, no, we can't do this because the equipment's not working, and then everybody gets their pay cut, it's not a good situation for that person, you know?
Right.
You don't want to speak out or something like that.
That's it. So you just think, like, institutionally, the way that kind of system was set up by the management to just, you know, nobody wanted to say anything. Just reminds me of, like, that famous Korean Airlines thing where they're like, in Korea, they didn't want to talk bad about their superior, so they would just sit there silently as the plane crashed into a mountain because they didn't want to say to their co-pilot, pardon me, I'm not sure, like, he could be drunk asleep with his face on the wheel as it's crashing down, and he doesn't want to break the social code of saying, excuse me, kind gentleman, I think that you know, maybe you got into the sake bar, we're about to hit it, you know, so he would just silently gonna die now, you know? It's just like there's a certain, it's kind of maddening, but that's why you're around keeping things safe. We're driving by a big chemical plant or something, refinery of some kind.
I think that's the Marathon. I think it's in Norco.
What is it?
It's I think it's a Marathon plant it's a refinery in Norco, Louisiana. You can see from my tan here.
But do we still need to use oil, or is oil obsolete?
It's not obsolete because the technology is there to oil. They're hanging on right now. They're doing the best they can to hang on. They've squashed other technology, the petroleum companies, for many, many years. They've really tried to eliminate any kind of technology that would get rid of you know, you need for petroleum products. So, they're not going to be able to hold on forever with that. And some of the petroleum companies are actually getting into alternative fuels at this point and alternative energy because they see the writing on the wall. Eventually, it's going to change. You know, but it's gone on a little too long, longer than it should have. I do agree with that.
It's almost like we have to kind of reset the whole system. Like, if our dollar is based on oil, then, like, the government's not going to be into changing it. And so, you know, we got to just get a new currency, maybe, start fresh from everything and just kind of fix it up. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
But who's going to have those kind of balls? It seems like there's a cabal at the top, and they got shit pretty wired, but, you know, who knows? I don't know. I don't want to get political. I have a lot of crazy people on my podcast, like Carrie Cassidy of Project Camelot, put weird ideas in my head, get me to think too much. But also, I'm trying to get Andrew Bashago on my podcast. He was a time traveler for the CIA. You know, I love talking to these people. Anyway. He met George Washington. He went back in time during the Revolutionary War and gave him an empowered speech that he memorized in an underground bunker and then appeared in front of George Washington, saluted him, gave him a message, and then went back in time to the CIA, which was doing this in the 1970s. I don't know if it's true, but I watched a 6-hour long documentary on YouTube about it. And now I can be diagnosed on the spectrum. So, who knows what the hell that did to my brain, but that's what I'm doing with my time. I'm trying to find shit out.
Who's this guy?
His name is Andrew Bashago.
I don't even know that name.
Look him up, but he's a lawyer in Washington State, so he functions enough to, like, be a lawyer. But who knows how crazy those people are. You're going to look at, like, tax code all day and not go crazy? I think all lawyers are fucking bananas. It's like, you can do this if this guy's present, and then this guy puts a wig on and signs some document, and then it's a law, and then I gotta see this bureaucrat. You have to know who. It's just endless fucking wheel chasing. Who knows what the hell they're doing all day? Lawyers, you know, trying to move magic around of words on paper that people can't do or something. I don't know. Certain substances, legal, illegal, you know?
What do you know about, like, Pontchartrain here, you know, the history of...
No idea.
Oh, yeah. Sometime in the 1960s, they had a plane that crashed in the lake there.
Lake Pontchartrain?
Yeah.
We're driving over it right now?
Right. I don't think they found any bodies from the wreckage. I think it's all like in the silt down there in the mud.
Uh-huh.
I think that it hit so hard, and the lake is extremely shallow. So the plane is still out there somewhere with all the bodies and stuff. It's just, it's so shallow, so soft, and it hit. It's just, there were a couple famous people on there too. Not famous enough for me to remember them, but they were famous, I guess.
Is there a conspiracy about it? Like
No.
They knew too much and they were running from the law?
No, I don't think so. Just a
crash.
Yeah, just a crash. Yeah.
All right.
Trying to spread some history on you, but bring up the fact that I'm related to two of the three guys who broke out of Alcatraz.
Uh-huh.
The Anglin brothers there. My grandmother was like a first cousin or second cousin to him or something like that. I always thought that was bullshit, you know. You never know, I mean, if it's real or not, but I've seen pictures of them that she has, and they're actually, they came from her area and stuff like that, so I'm some related to them somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not quite as crafty as they are, but I did get the criminal gene. Also, have you ever seen the documentary Vernon, Florida?
Of what?
Vernon, Florida. It's about a little town in Florida. They have, it was done by Errol Morris, maybe somewhere around 1980. And the story that he wanted to do was about the people there that were amputating limbs for insurance settlements, right?
Whoa.
Yeah, they were just like, well, you have a policy, you get like 10 grand for an arm or whatever it is, so we'll cut your arm off, you know? And the insurance agents were in on it and others were in on it. And he did a documentary about that, but then he got death threats. So he had to, ironically, he had to cut that part out of the amputations.
Right.
And just do it about the people of the town and cut it down to about 40 minutes. Very popular documentary. But the thing is, I had a great uncle who was missing an arm. And my dad always told me that he had cut it off for insurance money, for an insurance settlement, right? And my mom, it was her uncle, so she's like, no, that's not true. And then I had heard about Vernon, Florida, and I started to read up on the town, and I looked to see where my Uncle James lived.
Uh-huh.
And it was 10 minutes from Vernon, Florida.
Oh.
And I was like, oh my God, it's true. And then they had another cousin that was missing an arm, you know. And I tell people that story, and they're like, oh, that's bullshit. No, it's a true story.
What the fuck were they doing with these arms?
I don't know, man. I don't know. I'd like to get
some insurance agents like, look, we'll put arms in a dumpster and I'll make a fortune. Listen, here's how it works. You get the insurance money. You cut off the arms. You call a doctor. We all sign paperwork. Everyone gets paid. Weird.
Yeah, I heard he had done it with a shotgun, actually. He shot it off the shotgun. And I've been to the town a couple times and
he shot his own arm off?
Yeah.
And then got paid?
Yeah. Well, it was accidental, of course.
According to,
yeah.
But he shot his own arm off.
Right.
Who are you suing?
It's a settlement. They have insurance coverage, and they could say, you know, it's an accidental. Dismemberment kind of deal.
One guy came up to him and said, listen, you need an insurance policy, wink, wink, that your arm doesn't get shut off, wink, wink.
What? Right.
Wouldn't that be weird if you got your arm shut off?
Right. Well, see, James, they had a cousin, Louie.
Yeah.
Who I think the story was he had cut his arm off with an axe. Or he got his buddy to. I don't know.
Everyone in the family.
Right, right. Cut his arm off with an axe or his buddy or something like that. And then my Uncle James is like, you know, that's a good idea, man. You're thinking, man. You're a businessman. I'm going to follow your path there. Teach me.
What is he invest in?
How to make money.
What does he invest in other than Coors Light after he does that? Like, did he savvily invest his 10 grand and make himself a big wig?
He invested in one-arm shirts after that.
Everyone in the family?
That money was long gone, man. Shortly after, it was gone. I'm sure, you know. Yeah.
Jeez. How many people total? Two in your family?
Yeah, two that I know all about.
Wow. Gotta go in the archives. So, he named the insurance companies. I wonder what they were doing with these arms.
No, they have a process. Like, I mean, the hospitals dispose of them or something like that. They are, you know, biohazard stuff. I'm sure they had it all worked out. I mean, And I've gone to that town a couple of times, and I've asked around some about they actually called it Nub City at one point. It was nicknamed Nub City, and I asked them about the amputation and stuff like that, and people just looked around, and they knew about it, but they didn't want to talk about it openly.
Right,
they didn't want to talk about it in front of anybody else, so it's still a shameful secret there.
If you're doing a stand-up in Nub City, don't make any Nub jokes, because they're real touchy, because everyone got their arm chopped off in an insurance scheme. Could get yourself banned from that place if you do any fucking Nub jokes.
Yeah, that's what I come from, man.
Bunch of criminals.
Yeah,
Nazis
too. I come from Nazis too.
Really?
Yeah, my grandmother, she grew up in Nazi Germany.
Uh-huh.
And I have some fantastic pictures of her, family pictures, government family pictures.
Uh-huh.
And they are all dressed up, just a beautiful family and everything. And above them, there's a picture of Hitler and the swastikas and the whole bit right behind them. Huge.
Yeah.
You know, and they have a number on it. It's like family such and such number, whatever, you know. But
this is the perfect German household. Look at that block. Blue as the ocean.
They did have the look. They had the right look, the blonde hair, blue-eyed.
Yeah.
Stiff arm, the whole bit, you know. No.
But their wallets were made of Jew skin. They were the happiest family.
I think my grandmother was about 15 when that picture was taken. And so, she, you know, it's just, it was a way of life then, you know. So,
right.
But I grew up looking at all these swastikas and stuff like that, not really thinking much of it. It's just an old picture of my grandparents and my great-grandparents and my grandmother and stuff. So I didn't really think much of it until later on. And now I look at it now, and she's passed away. And I look at it, and it's just so weird to me now to realize what actually went on. I would have liked to have talked to her a little bit more about it, you know.
Right. That is... But that's, again, like, people get touchy about their history, you know. Then it's like... Well, what about all these Nazi plates? Well, they were matching plates, and they were very organized. They were made of great materials. I can't use these Nazi plates anymore. Why not?
But I'm talking about Nazis and all this other stuff. I'm not advocating anything. I'm simply talking about my history.
Right.
You know, it's like, this is my experience. Like, if somebody talks about something on stage or something like that, talk about it, and they drop an N-bomb or something like that, if they're quoting someone else, that if they're, you know, if it's, I don't understand how people can say you can't say that when it's actually an experience that you've had and you're just relating the experience. You didn't, you know what I'm saying?
Trigger words. Stop talking.
Trigger words. Not that I would, I really don't do that.
I always think that trigger words just make the word more powerful. You know, when anything that's a taboo, you know, like, I don't know. It's just like, if it's the restricted part of the documentary where they name names of the insurance company, they tell you the bankers, the doctors were involved. If it's one of those documents, I only want the 20 minutes that was redacted, you know.
Yeah.
I only want to watch that part of the documentary. That's where they're fucking getting hardcore, naming names, calling people out, telling you exactly how they did it. Of course they're getting death threats, you know. But, I don't know. Just like pornography. I only want to see the illegal stuff, you know what I mean? I only want to... That's the only stuff I'm interested in, because it's a taboo.
It's your first time to Lafayette?
Yeah. Your first time to Lafayette?
No.
Okay, you've been to this club before that we're going
to? No, not the club. My office is actually in Lafayette. I come here quite a bit.
So, what's that like when you're on the rig? It's all just like, is that kind of where you refined your sense of humor that you were working on in South America at first? Then you go on the oil rig and you try out some stuff, and there's these crazy guys who
actually,
you know, have no boundaries.
I do safety meetings every day, a couple times a day, and I do, it's about 20 minutes, 30 minutes each time. So
right.
I'm in front of a big group of people, like 20 minutes each day, and I do slide a joke in there every now and then and try it out, you know?
Yeah.
It's funny because it's an old school profession and stuff like that, but it's amazing. I started in 93 in the oil field, and it's amazing the way things have changed, what's acceptable and what's not now. you would think, I mean, people, homophobia and stuff like that is not acceptable out there anymore.
Right.
Somebody uses the word fag or something, like, hey, you know, some big redneck, you think.
What, on
oh,
the
man,
rig?
He's, yeah.
Right.
Some big redneck or something, you think he's going to agree with. It's like, you know, that's not really the proper word these days. You shouldn't really say that. You know?
Right.
It's insane, man. I never thought it would change quite that much. There's some good people out there, even though they, even if they're on the redneck side, they understand. Maybe one of, you know, I saw a big redneck guy say that one night. It's like, you can't really use that word. And I come to find out his son is gay, you know?
Right.
So the way things have changed, it takes a little bit more time to get out there, those guys, though. Because it's a bunch of men together, blue collar and stuff like that. But it's amazing how political correctness or you know, proper nomenclature can kind of bleed its way into there. And people can start to think of everybody as inclusive, you know. And I'm rambling.
No, not at all. Yeah, it's interesting. But, like, at certain time, you know, obviously a bunch of guys get together, they want to bust balls, they want to make each other laugh, they want to, like, pass the time in a constructive way, you know?
Yeah.
And so that things aren't so boring, you know? So, yeah, of course. You do some jokes, try some material, make the safety meeting more fun, you know, when people are, you know, not that they should be, like, when they're trying to screw in the bolts of the stuff, they shouldn't be, like, humping the wrenches and stuff and being crazy. Just, like, making crazy jokes and, you know, getting drunk. But, you know,
yeah,
you should be having a good time, making the best of whatever your situation is.
Yeah. I try to talk to everybody I can out there, but I'm not into hunting and I'm not into, you know, guns. And
right.
Whatever, fishing. There's only so many people that I can actually talk to about things that I'm interested in. But there's some good guys. I've met some great people out there. And some assholes.
I think hunting and fishing is good, you know. Probably a healthier way to get your food from.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I'm not opposed to it. It's just not something that I do.
Yeah.
And they love to talk about it. You know?
Right.
Love to talk about it.
This 10-point buck, yeah, staring at me, eyeballing me from across the way. I only had a crossbow, so I threw my knife through its face. Jumped 10 feet in the air, maybe 30. So it's a lot of that kind of
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, it's pretty much the same story every time. I saw a deer, I shot at it,
yeah.
I killed it. Or I saw a deer, I shot at it, and I missed it. Right. That's the basic story, you know?
Then they chop it up and make it for supper.
Right. But that's the whole story. Every
right.
time it's like that. It's the same story every damn time.
Right.
Maybe the situation changes a little bit. It's like, oh, it was really cold that morning. But the story arc is always the same. So I can predict what's going to happen, you know?
Right.
So I like to mix it up a little bit every now and then. I mean,
you're trying to raise their level of comedy by showing them what the fuck you learned in the clubs.
Yeah, it's
getting your reps in.
Yeah, I suggested one time that they practice catch and release hunting, you know, like catch and release fishing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they... So, actually, a couple of guys laughed at that, but the others were like, what? It's kind of silly, though. I mean, the catch and release fishing to me, you catch it, you look at the fish, and then you put it back, you know?
Right.
It doesn't harm the fish. It's kind of like a child molester riding around and picking up a 5-year-old and driving him around the block and just leering at him for a while and then just take it out. You're done. I don't understand that.
Also, you know, when you catch and release a fish, you like throw a hook through its mouth and really damage it.
Yeah.
Pierce its gull and then you just throw it back in going, that'll be fine without the side of its fucking gulls. No, you fucked it up. You might as well eat it if
yeah,
it's the right
it.
Size.
Yeah.
Same thing with a child, you know. You might as well eat it if you got in your car.
You're gonna get to that point, you know.
I don't mean that, okay? That's a joke. I don't think you should eat a kid that you pick up off the street, obviously. World's changing, you know? Make sure you're on the right advocacy group, I guess. Just took a pee-pee break. You're telling me about you were recording your sets with a GoPro.
Yes.
How's that helped?
Yeah, it's good. It still has the fisheye effect to it. I'm going to have to adjust the setting so I look especially round.
Right, right. And, makes you hit the fat button.
Yeah, it's like, wow. But, I realized that I'd move unnecessarily quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I'm playing with the microphone cord and stuff that I never realized.
Do you think that you could, benefit from acting out jokes instead of, just wasted jittery movement? You know, like use your body to, pantomime stuff or whatever?
That's part of my plan now. That's what I'm trying to do now, put my jokes in logical order. Use good transitions, maybe use some physical movements and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And not just movement to be moving.
You get into a shame spiral when you watch your material over and over and obsess about all the things that you could have done better?
I cringe, man. I cringe when I see it and you know, just like everybody does. Just like the audio, I can't stand the sound of my voice. Video, I'm just the whole bit, you know, it's pretty natural. Somebody look at themselves in the video, it's like, oh god, or something like that. Just think about things you could have changed.
Yeah,
I've heard big time comedians talking about specials that they had done the year or two before, and they watch it, and it's like it was all perfectly timed material, everything was great, but they wish they had added more to it, you know,
right.
Stuff that they had been working on for a couple of years to get an hour down for a special. And then they watch it a year or two later, and they still have things to critique. So it's a never-ending process there.
Yeah, you're wondering, oh, if I added two... I'm already in this subject. What if I add two more things? Mm-hmm. But maybe it's also like, no, that was enough. And you dug it for what it was worth. You only did the gold. You know, who knows? But, I noticed that sometimes it's not just like saying the joke or punchline that you think. Sometimes it's that extra thing about what you think about the subject that makes it people laugh. Like, you say a subject and you think the premise is funny, but then it's your opinion of the premise that's funny.
Yeah.
If you have an interest. So, sometimes I'll just say things and then I'll expect a laugh and then they want me to kind of spell it out in another sentence or something like this of how I feel about the situation. But, yeah. So, it's kind of fun.
Yeah, I know grown men are like that, though.
Of course.
They get away from their wife or something, they go ape shit, you know?
They start getting crazy, get drunk.
Yeah, I know, guys. They get away from their wives or something like that. Sometimes I have to physically restrain them. You know, like, calm down. Just calm the fuck down.
Right,
it's going to be okay,
People
man.
From the oil rig, they go from port to port, and they try to bang the locals. Is that what you're getting at?
No, it's just friends, old friends, or even family members and stuff like that. They get out, and they do the family thing and all that, but when they get free somehow, it's like, I have this a lot of time
to do this
crazy shit, and I'm going to do it right now tonight.
Yeah.
And me, I have that option every night, so I'm not in a hurry to do that crazy stuff. You know, it's just, that's the way of life for me. For them, it's just they have that time frame.
You have your freedom just to go to Lafayette and just do a comedy show.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a hard thing to give up. It's interesting. It is weird when you see people, in a restrictive environment, and then they get in an open environment, and how they lose their mind.
Yeah. Yeah, these guys, they go out ridiculous. A lot of them cheat on their wives and all this, and then a few years later, they're whining, like, why is she divorcing me? I wonder why. What did I do?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Do you think that they find out, or do you think that that was like a systemic issue that happened for something else?
A lot of them do find out, it's like, you caused this problem.
Do they confess like 5 years later or something?
No, it depends, but if you want to be single, be single. If you want to be married, then you be married, you know? You commit or you don't. The in-between is where the mess comes in.
Right.
I don't know. Like, I'm talking about marriage. I've never been married, so I don't know. Giving people advice on marriage.
No, but I like my situation, too, because, there's always every semester that I'm living at a privateer place at UNO, there's a new crop of foreign people that just kind of are there for 4 months and then split. Mm-hmm. A lot of Brazilian girls and stuff, so I'm having plenty of chances. I am striking out, though. My fucking French roommate, all the American girls love his accent. They're over, every night, hanging out till all hours, trying to get him to see. They were... all these girls, literally, knocked on my door at, 11 a.m. or 11 p.m. They come inside. They demand to see my roommate's boobs. He's a dude. His name is Robin. And they're like, show us your tits, Robin. And I'm like, listen, my client is not just going to show your his tits willy-nilly. He would participate in a game of spin the bottle where whoever the bottle happened to land on could show their tits. He might participate. But we're playing for both full tits to be seen if the bottle hits on you. That's what you want to see on my client, and that's what you're going to get if the bottle lands on you. And so we started playing this game, and then the girls started cheating, you know. They were only showing a little bit of cleavage on the top, and so I got bored and kicked them out. Because they started cheating after they saw old Frenchie's tits. They started cheating, because that's all they came for. Treating him like a piece of meat. Unbelievable.
So does he have, like, female breasts? Like,
No.
Man titties or something?
They just wanted to see his chest, I guess.
Okay.
Maybe they were wondering if he had abs or had chest hair. I don't know. I guess it's just a Mardi Gras thing. They got it in their head that they could objectify him.
Yeah.
You know? But he's got a French accent, so everything he says, he's getting, like, messages from girls late at night going, like, oh, you're like a color I never knew existed, I've never seen before, but is more beautiful than all the other colors in the rainbow, you know?
Yeah.
I swear, he's getting messages from girls flicking their beans at 3 a.m. texting them shit.
I travel a lot, and it's funny because I'm the exotic guy when I go places, you know. It's
like, when you go to Peru?
Yeah, when I go to Peru or even like Asia or something like that, it's like, you know, I was going to say blonde hair, but the blue-eyed guy, you know. It's
right,
like,
right.
Different color of skin, different color of eyes. It's funny to be the exotic guy.
When I was young, I went to Germany, and I was the... Because I had an American accent, I was, you know, the exotic guy. So I started pulling way out my league in Germany, you know? It's all about where you're from. But he just gets away with stuff, you know? Can say different things because he's got that French accent, you know? He sounds like he's fumbling around with his English. He's like, I'd like to get to know you better, for example, your pussy. You know? He just goes, just gets away with it. I don't know what I'm saying. But I'm serious.
I can imagine.
Like every single night, one of them. There's three girls that are his admirers, but one of them knocks on the door every single night. They're like a little club of girls who are all like, we are starting a club because one of us is going to fuck him. Like, that's how it seems like to me. They're over every night! And they're just messing with him. And he's like, oh, I have such a big problem. I have a girlfriend back in France and three girls want to fuck me. I'm like, I really want your problems, dude. I want your problems. Too much pussy. And then I just immediately creep out the Brazilian girls, you know. But what are you going to do?
Learn a little Portuguese. Learn to dance. That's all you got.
Yeah, I know. I don't know.
The Brazilian girls, you dance, you're good.
I need to learn some capoeira or something.
I met this lady a couple weeks ago, and we went out. But it was like a 10-day relationship, you know?
Yeah.
And I knew there was a problem right away when she didn't like Seinfeld. She was like, it's not that she didn't watch it, she disliked it, you know?
Right.
And that was the only thing. We had so many other things that we could talk about. Movies and esoteric bullshit that we both knew about.
Uh-huh.
When she said she didn't like Seinfeld, she hated Seinfeld, I was like, this could be a problem in the long run.
Right.
It's a personality issue.
How else did her not liking Seinfeld manifest in the relationship?
It's a sensibility, I think, that you have. Certain things, you know. She didn't get my references half the time.
Right.
No, and then the bitch side started to come out in her. I was like, yeah, I was right. Spot on.
Right, just not understanding your sense of humor, stuff like this.
I nuanced it. Well, she kept telling me I wasn't funny. That didn't help me.
Jeez, that's rude.
When she knew I did comedy, I had to tell her because I left every night at like 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock.
Right.
Like, I gotta go. It's like, were you married or something? No, I actually do comedy, you know. I tell people I'm in the oil field. They think I'm funny. I tell them I'm in comedy. They don't think I'm funny at all. I don't understand if there's a perception there. You know? I was like, well, tell me a joke.
Right.
Okay, all right. It's about perception.
That's,
I'm still the same guy.
Yeah.
Funny or not, I don't know.
No, I think you're funny, dude. I see a guy trying hard with a positive attitude who doesn't have an ego and is just doing it and seems to love it. And, you know, that's the energy I like. But the energy I don't like is this kind of elitism where it's like, do you even fucking know who I am? At any level. At any level. You could, like, you know...
Yeah.
Who wants to hear a story about Will Smith where he's pulling, like, do you know who the fuck I am? That's him being at his rudest. No one likes that. Like, if you're fucking just nice to everybody, then that's what I'm into, and have a positive attitude.
He's Will Smith, but in his early days, he was Will Smith, you know? He's changed. He's the new Will Smith, is what he is. He used to say that when he was younger, like, when he was the Fresh Prince, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
His rapping days, not sitcom Fresh Prince.
Oh, okay. He had to change his personality, too.
And now he's Will Smith. He's come a long way.
But, yeah, that is interesting how, like, people's taste of art say so much about them, you know? It's like, see, but people might think I'm stupid because, like, if I go to an art museum with paintings on the wall at this part in my life, I could not be more bored. Unless it's around New York and there's an open bar every place. Just go to New York and just, like, you know, they have, like, free wine walks where they give out free wine and they want the rich people in the neighborhood to buy paintings for thousands of dollars. So I'd go around there and drink wine and go on a booze cruise. And yeah, maybe there was paintings on the wall, but God, if I go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art or something like that, I'm just like,
yeah,
it's kryptonite. I hate it. I
went to the Louvre, man. It was brutal.
It's boring?
Yeah, it was so boring, man. So boring. It was, half of it was a mall, a shopping mall.
Right.
And the rest, it was just like, all the paintings look the same. It's just hallways and hallways and hallways. And they put the Mona Lisa all the way in the back, you know?
Right.
You have to go through the maze to find it.
Right.
And I got to the point where, like, I really don't care to see the Mona Lisa.
Yeah.
I don't care. I'm done. I'm going to go to the Starbucks over in the mall there and drink up and just wait for the people I'm with.
Yeah, I don't know. Because... for me, like, jokes are, like, the art that you can get the most out of, you know? Yeah. It's like back in the day when Picasso started doing whatever, he was, like, changing the idea. Oh, maybe you draw someone with their eye up here, and the people are like, wow! But now it's like, you know, I want to see weird jokes in a comedy club. That's what, as far as me, gets their kicks on different things. But, yeah.
Same thing with like poetry. I mean, poetry bores the shit out of me. But I've got this friend Thaddeus Conte. He's a great New Orleans poet. There, he's really bizarre. Good guy, man. Just he's put out a few books and stuff like that too. I keep trying to talk him into doing stand-up comedy, but he hates it. But his mind is of the stand-up.
He
has the stand-up comic mind.
So right.
He's a brilliant guy.
Putting it through poetry.
Yeah.
He's just like an artist. Yeah, that's interesting. It is weird how, like, you know, also I think about people like Trey Parker, Matt Stone, who are my comedy idols who do South Park, but Trey Parker's never done stand-up. He has no interest in it. His medium of comedy is animated cartoon, you know, or, you know, Team America World Police with puppets. That's how he communicates his art form, which is interesting, you know?
Yeah, so I heard a podcast with Will Ferrell at WTF.
Yeah.
Martin Maron. He said he tried stand-up at first, and, like, the first three times that he signed up, he just left on them, you know, before it was his time to go. He freaked out, and he got up there a few times, and it just didn't work out for him. I mean, who you know, you get up there a couple times, how many times is it going to work out in the first couple of times? But
right.
He does... more of a long form kind of thing, and I was thinking if Will Ferrell had any problem with it in the beginning like that, I felt a lot better about what I was doing, you know. Like,
yeah.
Somebody like Will Ferrell had issues with it, and I didn't take off the first time I signed up. I wanted to leave. As I was going up to the stage, I was actually considering, do I go to the stage or do I go out the side door when they called my name?
Right.
You know? But I went up and did it, and I'm glad I did. But, yeah, if a guy is brilliant as Will Ferrell has that kind of issues.
Well, you know, I did improv for a long time, and it is a different thing. You know, you kind of spread the blame if it doesn't go well to your whole troupe of people who are trying to improvise the scene on the spot. So yeah. It's just a super different muscle. You know, you're kind of like, it's like the difference between kibitzing and, you know, going up and making a speech. It's like, you know, it's a different ballgame. And I've had improv teachers tell me that they're scared of stand-up. You know, some people just, the way that their brain works, they just want to deliver their comedy through like this. And I have a lot of respect for improv. But there's no venue on television where it even happens anymore. I don't see it as something. It's like, it's an art that helps other things. I'd like to produce an improv TV show with, like, proper long-form improv on TV. I think it could work, but nobody's done it before. Now it's so great, because whenever any comic at any level, if they put an hour together and film it themselves, you know, it doesn't cost that much money to make it perfect. Yeah. And then you front yourself, invest in your own stuff, and then, you know, put it in the court of public opinion and see what happens. So I think it is a really great time for comedy right now.
It is the technology, and it's really, and you can control the content. You don't have to, you know, if someone else is financing it, you kind of have to go by the guidelines. You can finance it yourself, take the technology and stuff, and put it out there, put it exactly as you want it to be.
Yeah. It's like much less expensive than an indie movie, but it is an indie movie, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, what are your goals? Do you want to like get a certain proficiency and then like, you know?
My only goal when I started was just to be good at it. I know that's kind of vague and stuff like that. I just wanted to be able to be a good stand-up comic, and anything above that is great. You know, I just wanted to be able to get up there, control the situation, make people laugh, really laugh, you know, and do my thing. And if somebody paid me to do it, even better, you know, or if I got to do it with somebody really cool or really famous, even better, you know, anything above that. But my only goal was to be good at it.
Right.
And I set out with the work ethic to do it, you know, the formula of just keep writing and keep getting on stage.
That's great.
I know that's really short, you know, but I kept it very simple.
ISIS is supporting themselves. Is that the light? Okay. Shit. all right, I'm out of here. Smoke pot and worship aliens. I've been Eric Hollenbach. Thank you very much.
So we just rolled out of Lafayette a little while ago. On the road back to New Orleans. How do you think it went?
It was a good show, you know, a little rowdy crowd.
They were a kind of a fired up crowd, weren't they?
Yeah, a bunch of coon asses drinking, but I grew up with those folks, so I can kind of...
A lot of heckling.
Yeah, real heckling too, not just light, a heavy dose of heckling. Yeah.
One of the guys was like, I'm sick of you, you know, just like to the comics. It's rough, but you know, I thought it went okay. I thought, you know, they had a lot of respect for the people, just like, oh, you're from New Orleans, Mr. City Balls, you know, like they're really they were really nice to us, so it was good. Yeah, you just kind of have to know how to kind of control them, talk at them a little bit, kind of mix it up with them so that you know that you're paying attention to them, so that they're like, oh shit, whatever if I do something crazy now, if I start, like, you know, talking loudly, I'm going to get called out, so I better mind my business. Kind of like a teacher, you know, in the school, you know. You don't want to get called out in front of the principal or something, so. I don't know.
A couple of those guys were so drunk that they didn't realize that there was a comedy show going on, I guarantee you. Fat guy with the long hair?
Yeah.
I don't think he realized it was an extra show going on. Yeah.
And then the one guy who gets up and then he like blows the light and he like, you know, plans to tell this story that's going to take 20 to 30 minutes long. And they're like, all right, you got 5 minutes. And he just is like, no, but this is part of the story what I do. It's like, no, you're done now. So all the comics in the back, there was like 4 comics flashing the light at him to get him off the stage. So that was fun. He was like the biggest heckler too.
Yeah, he was heckling like crazy.
He was heckling like crazy, and then it's like he got up to stage, and then he had a huge ego that he couldn't even get off stage after the light, you know?
Well, to his, I mean, honestly, the guy was from South Africa, so when they said 5 minutes, he was probably thinking in metric minutes.
Right, right.
You know? So that's like nine and a half minutes metric.
Yeah.
They weren't very clear on that.
Just a drunk asshole. I think he's one of those racists who's on the wrong side of the apartheid. White guy from Africa. You know. Thinks he's running shit wherever he goes. Imperialist British fuck. But, yeah, so, you know. But, everyone else was nice. The host was a nice guy. I'm not banned from there, so, you know. At least it's a spot to go to. Maybe we should go to Baton Rouge. It's a little closer to New Orleans, right?
As far as what goes.
As far as distance driving. Does Baton Rouge have any places to do stand-up?
Oh, yeah. They've got Wednesday night, the station. It's a couple others, too. They've got a couple shows there.
It's a little closer than Lafayette, you know?
Yeah.
Try that.
Hattiesburg's a little closer, too.
Hattiesburg's got some stuff?
Oh, yeah. It's a good scene there, man.
Really?
Yeah, it's like an up-city comedy. Good guys there. They've been building on it for about 5 years now, and they put a lot of effort into it. They've really built up Tom Segura.
He's gonna
go there first before he comes to Lafayette, and he's doing a really big club there. They have a music venue that they do comedy in.
Right.
And there's like 400 people that show up for the show.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Hattiesburg. Well, let's just keep doing that. Let's keep rolling and trying different places, you know. But
I'm going there tomorrow night.
Yeah,
you're in college. I
that's interesting. I mean, I have class at 11 on Tuesday.
Okay.
Let's talk about this not on the podcast.
Oh, we're on the podcast now.
Yeah, I'm recording.
Oh shit!
I can just cut that out. But you know, we could wrap it up.
Okay, that could be edited out. But no, it's a good show. You know, good coon-ass people, but I understand those guys.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You kind of have to deal with rednecks. They're kind of, like, loud, crazy, but, you know, if you make fun of them and in the right way, that they know that you're watching them, you know.
Yeah.
You kind of just got to embrace the chaos of the night and just, like, not try to fight it too much. Just kind of go with their energy, you know. But, anyway, that's another episode of Highway Diary in the motherfucking bag. Thanks to my guest, Kevin Passman, special going to Lafayette episode on the road. See you guys next time. Later.
I was doing a little bit in Peru, a little South America and all. They laugh at every fucking thing. My closer was a picture of a donkey there.